Hi, and welcome to Understory, the show where we delve into the environmental issues that matter. Today it's all about food and the dirt it comes out of. Alyssa Bielfeld, co-founder and director of the Cookbook Project, is on the line from Boston in the US to kick off the show and tell us about her new slow food initiative. Later we'll hear from Tim Marshall, author of the new Bible on Organic Gardening in Australia. But first to the US and to slow food. What's the Cookbook Project all about?
So the Cookbook Project is now officially a nonprofit organization. We're based in the United States, but the work we do takes place both domestically and internationally. So our core work is basically partnering with youth organizations to run food education workshops that are experiential in nature. And we use food culture as a vehicle for engaging youth about the topics of sustainable consumption and nutrition, and also helping them to develop cooking skills.
Okay, so probably not everybody has heard of slow food and the slow food movement. Can you describe to me what is slow food?
Yeah, so I guess our organization is based on the concepts from the slow food movement and also from the food justice movement, which is another movement that folks may or may not have heard about. So to start with, slow food is a movement that started in Italy in the 1980s, and it was mostly in reaction to a lot of fast food chain restaurants that were starting to become really common in Italy. And a group of Italians who were really proud of the Italian food heritage, and also, you know, local producers who have been producing amazing artisanal cheeses and, you know, vegetables for hundreds of years in Italy, responded by creating the slow food movement. You know, you think of the opposite of slow food, which is fast food. So it's a good way to kind of describe what they're all about.
And it makes sense in a way, doesn't it? If you think about Italy, it's for a very long time, a lot of the population of Italy has lived in the countryside. And even probably more than most other European countries, a lot of them still do. So it makes sense that the slow food movement came out of Italy. What's so great about the slow food movement?
Well, I think what's great about the slow food movement is it really supports people in making food choices that are local and regional and ultimately the most healthy. So from an environmental perspective, sourcing food from your direct area obviously reduces transportation costs. Economically, it helps to support, you know, the people around you who are actually a part of your community, which is really beautiful. You know, to be able to go to a farmer's market and connect directly with the farmer who produced your salad greens is really an amazing thing. And then from the health perspective, actually food that's transported less, that's fresher, retains more of its nutrient value than food that's had to be transported around the world or from, you know, distant places.
Okay, now let's get back to the Cookbook Project. When did you start it, and what was the thing that actually prompted you to begin this project?
My partner and I were traveling around the world. We had taken some time after getting married to do that. And we were first in South America, and then we were mostly in Asia, and we were trying to get involved in community development projects as volunteers. And we found it quite difficult to find organizations who would welcome us in to do short-term projects. So based off of that, and also just our own personal love for food and food culture, we're both really actively engaged in the food movement in the U.S. We thought that it would be, you know, wonderful if we could create a youth education curriculum that brought together the connection between food, health, and the environment. So the summer after the first year of our travels, we put together the curriculum, and the second year of traveling, we actually ran pilot workshops. So during 2010 and 2011, we ran 7 workshops throughout Asia and 2 workshops, most recently in the United States.
Okay. And can you give us a flavor, to use the obvious word, of one of these workshops? So take a recent one that you've run. What actually happens in these workshops?
The most recent one that we ran was actually at a community center in Harlem, which is a really underserved neighborhood in kind of the upper reaches of Manhattan. And so what's interesting about the United States, as opposed to some of the other places we've worked, is that the U.S. is a country of immigrants. So everybody who finds themselves in the United States, or at least the majority of people, originally came from somewhere else in the world. So people are bringing together all of these really unique food cultures. And so this workshop was really wonderful. We had a group of 16 students who are normally involved in extracurricular literacy programming. So they're kids who are currently failing out, essentially, of the school system because of their literacy skill levels. And so we worked with them to help connect the importance of literacy to cooking and nutrition and actually, you know, developing recipes. So the connection between literacy and the idea of recipe creation was really beautiful. So we had students whose families are from all over the world. We had some from Nigeria, from Honduras, from Jamaica. And so basically what happens in a workshop is the first day, it's really guided by the youth participants. And the first day, all the participants come up with a food culture recipe that they love. So a recipe from their family, from their background. So for instance, one of the participants, her family's from Honduras. And so the recipe she came up with is called machuco, which is a green and ripe plantain sort of mash recipe. It's kind of like mashed potatoes.
Can you get plantain in New York City?
Yeah, surprisingly, you can. I mean, New York City is sort of out of the ordinary in that way because they're so connected to the global food system. Another example was we had a student from Jamaica, and so she created a recipe based on an ingredient that's local to Jamaica that it's very difficult to find in the United States. It's called callaloo, and it's a type of green. And so we substituted a local green called collard greens, which a lot of people are familiar with, to make this same recipe. So basically what happens after the participants create their recipes, we use the recipes to then talk about concepts of nutrition and also sustainable consumption. And then the final day of the workshop, as we've sort of built up some cooking preparation skills over the previous few days, the final day, the group as a whole is split up into smaller groups who then work together to create a recipe for the group. And then the group shares a food culture meal, and it's a really wonderful learning experience and also a community building experience as well.
Sounds fantastic. So how can listeners in Australia get involved? Are you ever going to run one of these workshops in Australia, or is there any way people can donate to the cause?
Yeah, well, donations are for sure an option. We definitely need support. You know, we're really just in our first year of operation as a nonprofit organization, so that always helps. But Adam and I are really passionate about having the organization be grassroots in nature. So we developed a program called the Local Leaders Program. And through this, any individual or organization anywhere in the world can apply to lead cookbook project workshops. And so what happens is you apply through our website.
Just tell us your website for a minute.
It's www.thecookbookproject.org.
Great, okay.
And the application's available under, there's a programs page and more specifically a local leaders page.
Okay, well, that sounds fantastic. And here you're off to Haiti soon.
Yeah, so our next workshop that we're really excited about, we leave in less than a week actually to go down to Haiti where we're going to be training. We're doing a local leaders training at a reforestation project on the eastern border. So we'll be training some short-term volunteers who are working on the project from around the world and also 5 to 6 local aid workers as well. And then along with them, we're all going to work together to run a youth education workshop as well.
Well, that sounds really exciting. I wish I was coming too. Okay, well, thanks a lot for talking to us, Alyssa Bilfield. That was Alyssa Bilfield, co-founder and director of the Cookbook Project. Next, we return closer to Australia and go down to earth with Tim Marshall. Tim's certified hundreds, if not thousands, of organic farms across Australia and has just published The New Organic Gardener. I began by asking Tim about how he got into this game.
Well, I've been a gardener all of my life, and that really started as a child, gardening at the heel of my father, who was an exceptionally keen gardener and always involved me in the garden from the age of about five, I reckon. I have been involved in the organic industry, especially in the business of standard setting and certification for a long time, probably 30 years of involvement at that level. And I think that probably amongst the greatest achievements of my life would have been that I raised two daughters very largely, very substantially, on produce from my own garden.
And they're fit and healthy now, I can imagine.
Yes, they're extremely fit and well, and I have to say I do ascribe a fair bit of that to an excellent diet for themselves and for their parents. Yeah.
So you've done a lot of certifying of organic farms around Australia. Can you tell me about some of the more splendid food forests or gardens you've visited over the years?
Well, yes, there are amongst this, 2,200 or 300 or so certified organic farms in Australia, some absolutely amazing examples of what's possible using organic methods. And I have to say that one of the things that really attracts me to this is the wonderful simplicity of some of these systems. So to stand in Peter Watson's banana plantation at Tully in Queensland.
That's a beautiful area.
Yes, and to see his system of portable chicken house capable of holding 300 chickens, designed for the sunny climate without any insulation, to be moved around the farm, to deliver organic pest control, weed control, soil improvement, and to diversify his farm income with eggs that sell as far south as Sydney, and to see the beautiful little systems he has. For instance, the hens lay in an egg box, and the eggs roll down into a little continuous belt, and to harvest the eggs, you just wind a handle, a windlass on the continuous belt, and all the eggs come to you. Just terrific little systems like that that I really love.
That sounds great. Okay, well, let's get down to basics. Apart from the obvious thing that organic gardening doesn't contribute to adding green waste to landfill, you put it into your compost pile and then it ends up in your soil. What is so great about organic gardening?
Well, really, everything's great about organic gardening. In fact, even if you were not going to be strictly organic, if you were going to use chemicals, you'd still want to do all the things that are really recommended by organic gardening. You'd still want to improve your soil with humus and organic matter, and to improve your water use efficiency and the nutrient of the food that you produce, and etc. So everything's good about organic. In fact, we can produce some much better quality food. We can produce that without resort to chemicals. We can produce that without having a negative impact on the surrounding environment. We can use less energy while we're doing it. We can put more carbon into the soil, which means we're taking it out of the atmosphere, and in the soil we're talking about long-term storage, much longer than in trees. So the idea of organic gardening has always been to take plant-based carbon and using the right biology to turn it into soil carbon, and the average age of a piece of soil carbon in an Australian soil is at least 1,000 years. So we can do lots of good things with organic gardening.
Okay, well, you're in Adelaide right now, and we're listening to you in Perth. The climates aren't exactly the same, but we're both heading into summer, and it's both very hot. What tips do you have for somebody wanting to have a vegetable garden in a suburban backyard in Perth?
Well, the first thing to do is to do some soil improvement. Usually with sandy soils, you can take quite a lot of compost and mulch to keep the soil covered, usually with mulch, but also plant cover. I mean, ground cover is very, very useful in improving soils and keeping them cool.
Would you recommend gardening in pots or somehow basically not using the soil here because it really is a sand dune?
It is possible if you have, long-term tenure on a garden to do significant soil improvement with simply adding organic matter. So, you know, certainly all soils can be improved. I can understand that people perhaps in short-term tenure or in units and flats and things would grow in pots. And certainly from a water relations point of view, that's a good idea. But if you get soil growing right, no plant will ever do as well in a pot as it will in the soil. So, I mean, soil's ultimately the place to grow, I'm sure.
Okay, and one of your tips for organic gardening is to grow plant roots. What do you mean by that?
Well, the magic of organic growing, so far as there is any, is exactly what happens at the fine root hairs of the plant. That's where there's this amazing cooperation between a whole lot of soil organisms and the plant itself. And what we want to do in organic is to deepen soil so that plants have access to a wider range of minerals. That's one reason that we can use fewer chemical inputs, is we're encouraging the plant to properly exploit the soil. And if a plant is healthy, it's continuously growing new roots. And those new roots are lignified. That means they're produced of a more woody material than the leafy matter on the top. So when we recycle the leafy matter on the top of the soil, remember that where the roots, you know, every time you mow the lawn, for instance, now you've removed some of the photosynthetic potential of the lawn. So there's a small amount of photosynthetic material and a large amount of roots. Some of those roots die back. And when they die back, the organic matter will last longer and is more likely to be preserved in humus because it's completely happening within the soil. It's not exposed to as much atmosphere. There's not as much burning up of the organic matter. The organic matter from the soil from the surface burns very quickly. It feeds a soil food web, but it doesn't leave behind as much long-term carbon as the roots of plants. So in order to encourage better feeding of plants, we want plant roots. In order to encourage the healthy relationship between plants and soil organisms that do a lot of services for the plant for free, feed it and keep it healthy, and so that we can add more carbon to the soil. All of those things rely on healthy plant roots.
Okay, well, if anyone wants to discover more about how to have healthy soil in your garden, I suggest you consult Tim's new book, The New Organic Gardener. Thanks very much, Tim Marshall.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for listening to Understory. Remember, you can podcast the show by going to rtrfm.com.au and following the links. I'm Tom Wilson. See you next time.